listening to Harrismith Radio. Hey there, I'm your host, Wayne McPhail. This episode is about plays, a fictional farm, heroes, and highways. I start off by chatting with Dan Needles, a mainstay for Harrismith readers and the author of the Wingfield Farm Mediaverse. We touch on turnip-mashing drudges, the parallels between Walt and Dan, and how Needles is taken to the board himself these days. Next up, we learn about an ambitious charity that aims to plant a tree for every man and woman who served in Canada's armed forces. So, one way or another, we're getting back to roots. By the way, if you want to read Harrismith Magazine instead of listen to it, you can subscribe to the print version online at harrismithmag.com. And you can find Harrismith Magazine on selected newsstands across Canada. But for now, settle in for the next half hour of Harrismith Radio. For decades, Dan Needles' beloved character Walt Wingfield has been enthralling theater audiences across Canada. Needles' plays, columns, and tales, tall and real, paint a picture of what he calls a return to a loved community. Dan himself has made a life journey somewhat like Walt's. He shared some of his thoughts about that with me from his own farm in Simcoe County. Dan, thanks so much for joining us today. I wanted to start off, maybe we should start for folks who have lived the last 30 years in like a grass hut in Lansa Meadows and don't know about Wingfield Farm and the Wingfield Farm Enterprise. Can you tell me a bit about what it is?
Well, Walt Wingfield leaves his job on Bay Street and goes up Highway 50 to rural Ontario and buys a 100-acre farm. He wants to simplify his life and farm with horses. Well, he quickly discovers that his life is going to be much more complicated than anything he knew on Bay Street. He was looking for peace and quiet, but he discovers something far more important. He finds a human community, something that he never really found in his days in the brokerage. So the story of Wingfield is a story of a return to a loved community. I think the reason it struck a chord with Canadian audiences is that we're only a generation away from life on the farm. So it tapped into memories that lots of people have.
So, and it also strikes me, as particularly at the time that you first started writing it, that it's very aspirational in the way that Harrismith Magazine was for a lot of people, too, of that hearkening back to a simpler time. Was there a relationship with Harrismith that you had back then?
Well, I was probably traveling exactly the opposite direction because I've been raised pretty much in the country. And I had no illusions about living off the land. I knew how hard that was to do. And so I was going the other direction. And I was also raised in the theater. My parents were both theater people. My grandparents were and my great-grandparents were. So I was kind of the black sheep of the family. I ran away from the circus and ended up working for an insurance company. And it was while I was at the insurance company that I, much later than Harrismith's beginnings, like I was in the mid-80s when I decided that I would go back to the farm. I was in my mid-30s. So I got married and to a farm girl from up this way, and I moved back to a 35-acre farm in Simcoe County, and I've been there ever since. It's like 35 years now.
So how parallel is Walt's journey to your journey?
Well, Walt does a lot of things that I never really had the courage to do. I did have horses. I tried hooking them up to a few lawn ornaments, but I never actually plowed with a horse because unless you got a quiet team, that's a pretty dangerous thing to do. And I had a pretty bad train wreck trying to get these two horses to pull an ancient Democrat, and they kicked it to pieces. And I just threw the harness back in the stable and went up to the house and wrote a story about another guy who tried plowing with horses. I found it was much safer to write about something than actually do it yourself.
Right, especially when one horse goes to the left and one horse goes to the right because he's from Australia, right?
Yeah.
One of the things that you've said about the plays, and I find it very interesting, is that in an overarching sense, you said it was a return to a loved community or a loved place, but you've also said that it's about the death of the family farm. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Because I found that a very interesting observation on your part.
Well, I'll come to that in a roundabout way. My mother bought a farm north of Toronto in the mid-50s. Because her husband was an actor and never home. And she wanted a place that she could use as a writer's retreat, a place where she could raise her kids. So she bought this rundown pasture farm on the 7th line of Mona Township, and she took us up there in May every year and brought us back in October. So I went to school half of the year in a two-room school in Rosemont, and half the year in a big public school in North Toronto. So I made this back and forth thing for a decade. Some school superintendent told my mother that she couldn't do this, and so she did it for another 10 or 15 years. But she really folded us into that rural community. And she had a theater troupe. All the farm kids would come down and take drama lessons for my mom, and she would put on plays in the Orange Lodge with them, the Orange Hall up in the village. So whenever there was a strawberry supper or a fowl supper, Dorothy Jane's troupe would get up on stage and entertain afterwards. That just became a tradition. And I worked for all the farmers on the 7th line, and I worked for a livestock trucker that just took me all over rural Ontario to sales barns. And my earliest formative memories are growing up on the farm. And being from a theater family, theater is a nomadic profession. You never really belong in any one place. And I really put roots down in Rosemont. I loved the attachment these people had to a place. And I became very attached to it myself. But my mother said, and I'm coming back to your question, my mother said when I was about 8 or 9 years old, pay attention to this place. This is not going to be around very much longer. It's all unraveling. So pay attention to it while it's here. And I did. She was right. But by the time I was 20 years old, the traditional family farm that I knew had pretty much disappeared off the 7th line. And I felt very badly about that. I mourned its passing.
Why did you leave? I mean, it sounds like you had a fantastic life in terms of having a sort of nomadic theater mom and dad. You were living on a farm. You were enjoying it. You were driving around in a truck and seeing all these cool farms and meeting all these people. So why did you go to Toronto?
There was no way to make a living either farming or writing. I tried writing for the newspaper for a couple of years, but then I got lured back to the city to work with a politician at Queen's Park who became a cabinet minister, and I stayed with him for 5 years. And then I went down to a big life insurance company, and I was with them for 8 years. So it was really just to make a living that I went to the city. But I bought the farm up here 1978. That's more than 40 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I used it as a weekend place for 10 years. And then when I got married, my wife and I decided that we would move back here. By that time, the plays were on the boards and becoming well known. And I just thought I'd roll the dice and see if I could make a living as a freelance writer. When I was about 37 at that point.
Well, you said earlier that you didn't take some risks that Walt Wingfield did in terms of driving the plow, but in terms of driving your career, you took some risks.
It was a real leap of faith and a decision I've never regretted.
So I wanted to talk about the sort of logistics of writing the play in terms of something, again, that in one of the interviews that I read that you've done, you talked about this really interesting situation where as you got more famous, as Walt Wingfield got more famous, and people knew about the plays and knew what you were about, that they kind of knew that when they talked to you and when they told you their stories, you're going to turn that into play fodder, right? So how did that change your relationship with folks that were your neighbors or your friends when they suddenly thought, wow, if I tell them a really good story, maybe it will show up at Stratford, right?
Well, I started out being a little nervous about how the neighbors would respond to this, and they all piled into the Orange Lodge in the summer of 1984, I realized that quite a few people in the audience were actually in the play, and things right. could have gone seriously wrong.
Absolutely.
But they were all delighted by it, and I never got a whisper of criticism. I've always written fairly respectfully of rural people, and the stories have Walt always loses, and the rural people always come out on top, pretty much, in the Wingfield series. So there's not much to get upset about. But I noticed that people, they would come up to me and say, you were thinking of me when you did Don the Dairy Farmer, weren't you? Or they'd say, there's a very unlikable character in Wingfield's, Dry Cry McKelvey, who runs the, he's the hard-nosed building supply and feed mill operator who's always chiseling. And one guy said, that's me, isn't it? And I said, no, well, he's actually a composite. There's a bunch of people in there. It's not actually you. And he was so disappointed that I never did that again. I decided, if you see yourself there, then yes, that's you. I think that the principle is that people love to think they're interesting enough to be the stuff of literature.
Right.
They're interesting enough to be written about. And the flip side is, the worst insult you can give to a person is that they're not interesting enough to appear in your play.
Right. I want to talk about, in terms of their reaction to you, I want to talk about your reaction to Rod Beatty and his representation of Walt Wingfield. Because he takes your material and takes it to a whole other place, right, in terms of his characterization, his rapid-fire switching of characters in the play, and his delivery of the lines just really just makes them blossom. And, I mean, it's lovely writing anyway, but he just takes it up. So what was that like working with him and the first time you saw him embody not only Walt Wingfield but the other characters that you created?
Well, Rod and I go back to childhood in North Toronto. We played ball hockey together on the streets of North Toronto. We just lived a block apart. And when I was writing for the newspaper and doing the first Letter from Wingfield Farm columns, his mother collected them in a scrapbook. And Rod was always interested in that material. He read every one, and we yakked about the character. And when it came time to put it on the stage, he was very enthusiastic about it. And he'd been trained classically as an actor. He spent a number of seasons at the Stratford Festival. So he was a real craftsman and understands what you can do on stage. And then we entered a period of discovery, figuring out what you could do on stage with a one-man show. When Rod started out doing it, he really wrote the book on how to do a one-man show. I don't think anybody had put quite that many characters on stage and introduced them so deftly with just a tilt of the head or a different hat or an expression. And It was marvelous to see him in action. But then the Globe and Mail critic said, well, this is fine, but it's too bad he can't do women. Well, Rod took that as a personal challenge, and now there are more women in the Wingfield Farm plays than there are in Lysistrata. There's about 18 of them.
Right. So let's talk about one of them in particular, the Maggie character. I mean, he makes her a very sweet counterpoint to, well, sweet with an edge, right?
Oh my God, she's got an edge.
Yeah, a real edge. But there's a real sweetness there as well. You know, and I'm thinking of the scene where she basically renders the ram unconscious by making him ram into a concrete post, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so there, as you said, there's as, and then you said in an interview before that there's not a lot of sex in your plays, but there's violence, especially to farm animals, right?
Yeah.
So let's talk about the way he represents Maggie. Is that how you imagined that character and how you imagined the other characters that he brought to life?
Not at all. Maggie was a kind of turnip-mashing drudge into working around all these wretched men in the house. And it never occurred to me that she would be a love interest for Walt. But what Rod actually said, Maggie is not only the candidate, she's the only candidate. And I wrapped my head around that, and by the time the third play came around, she and Walt were married.
Right.
But that's how it happens with playwriting. You don't really know how the thing's going to end up or how it's going to land until you get into it. These characters have a life of their own. They used to be my friends, but now they're all over at Rod's place playing pool, and I don't get to see them anymore. They're very real people to Rod.
Now, your latest on-stage venture involves you, right?
Yeah, I'm up on stage with a folk singer, songwriter, and a storyteller himself, Ian Bell. He helped found the Vinyl Cafe on CBC with Stuart McLean. And he has a wide following down through the southwest of Ontario. And we've been on stage many, many times together, but generally one after the other. And the latest book that I have, I was on a book tour, and he joined me on stage, and I said, let's just stand up here and do this together. So he sang songs, and I told stories, and it ended up being really what we're talking about here, how I came to the farm, how I folded into the community, how I made my life here. Ian has the same sort of he views the countryside through the same colored glasses. And he has the same weird sense of humor that I do. The same things make him laugh that make me laugh. And so we've done about 30 of these shows together called True Confessions from the Ninth Concession. We've been all over Ontario with it.
Yeah. And they were based on the Harrismith columns that you did, right?
That's right. I started writing for Harrismith in 1997. So I've been over nearly 25 years now with the magazine. I have the back page, and I put people to bed after wading through the magazine. That's what Yolanda does with me with Harrismith. Yeah. She puts me on the back page.
Well, I'm certainly glad that you ended up there. And speaking of Harrismith and speaking of your farm, just to wrap up, what's happening on your farm right now?
Well, it's a springtime, and the lambs are coming, and the fields are drying up. I'm fixing fences and got my seedlings planted out in the greenhouse, and I'm working. We're in the middle of this pandemic at the moment, and all my kids are home unemployed, so I have to have a project for them every day. And I'm building a shop for myself in the barn for the something I've wanted to do for 35 years, and it takes a pandemic to get something like that accomplished.
What do you want to do with the shop?
I want a warm place where I can change a tire in the winter. This is going to be insulated. Call me a sentimental old fool, but there's two things I've always wanted to do on the farm. One is circle the barnyard with power steering, and the other is to change the oil without getting frostbite.
Well, there you go. Well, I hope that works out for you. It sounds like a really good project. And I'm not going to call you an old fool. I will call you sentimental. and that's a wonderful thing. And I'm really glad that that you ended up on the back page of Harrismith. And for a lot of people, Dan, you know, the back page is the one you open first, right? You flip through a magazine backwards. So you could say you have pride of place on the first page of Harrismith.
Well, that's lovely to hear after all these years. My daughter says, you can't go out of fashion, Dad. You never were in fashion. You're not a trend.
Well, I'm glad that you're around, and I'm glad that you're continuing to write. And thanks very much for being in Harrismith, and thanks very much for talking to me today.
A pleasure, Wayne.
That was Dan Needles, who spoke with me from a place he calls home. Mike Hurley is the executive director of the Highways of Heroes Tree Campaign. That initiative originally planned to plant, along the highway from Trenton to Toronto, one tree for each of Canada's 117,000 servicemen and women who died for their country. Now they have an even more ambitious goal, 2 million trees for all of those who have served. I talk with Mike about the project and how we can help. Here's that conversation. Hey, Mike, thanks very much for joining me. So tell me a little bit about the Highways for Heroes tree planting campaign. I know about the Highway to Heroes. It goes from Trenton to Toronto. But tell me about the tree part.
Yeah, so a little while back, a group of organizations, fellow tree planting organizations, got together for a bit of a think tank day and brainstormed ideas on how they could increase the urban tree canopy. The urban tree canopy in Southern Ontario had been decimated, and they wanted to find ways to get it back to 40%. And one of the gentlemen in the room was Tony DiGiovanni, who is the executive director of Landscape Ontario. And being involved in a project where they landscaped the Veterans Memorial Parkway in London, Ontario, he drew inspiration from that and said, why don't we reforest the Highway of Heroes? We could plant a tree for every Canadian that had ever lost a life along the highway. That would be 117,000 trees. And immediately, everybody latched onto the idea and said, that's it. There's our idea. From there, they had to get an agreement with the Ministry of Transportation. And once that was all said and done, in the fall of 2015, we set off on our mission and planted the first trees in order to begin the construction of this living memorial to our armed forces servicemen and women.
So is that crown land along the highway, or how do you get access to that?
Yeah, it is owned technically by the Ministry of Transportation of Ontario. So as you can imagine, working with the bureaucrats, going through the process of getting an agreement in place with them in order to allow us and our contractors to access their land was a bit of a process in itself. But we were able to hash out an agreement with them. And currently, the Highway of Heroes, through our sister organization at Landscape Ontario, are now the only outside organization permitted to plant trees on ministry property.
Now, are you supplanting stuff like Crown Vetch or what was in there before you started putting the trees in?
A lot of times this is either a linear site, so it's you know, space between on-ramps, just set back a little bit from the highway, that there is some space between there and the natural forest edge or any developments within urbanized areas that we can plant on. And there's also quite a bit of space that is available at interchanges. So where the newly constructed 412 comes down and meets the 401 in Whitby there, where the new 418 will be connecting to the 401. Of course, everyone knows where the DVP and 401 are. And frankly, all the other interchanges provide great opportunities for us to put in some trees and in many cases actually put in some landscape designs as well, too.
So what kind of trees are you planting?
They are all native species. It's a mix of about 30 or so different natives, coniferous, deciduous, mix of both. And really our mantra is the right tree in the right place. So individual planting site presents its own unique conditions. We go in and do a bit of an assessment, and we work closely with a group called the Vineland Research Institute. This is a group of doctors and scientists that have been researching the best protocols for roadside tree planting methods, because as you can imagine, the roadside is not the most hospitable place for trees. But we follow their guidelines pretty closely. And really what it comes down to, what the research shows, is that it's about site preparation. And if you prepare the right conditions, which include loosening up the soil, reintegrating organic matter, your survival rates really jump. Typical roadside planting survival rates are only about 50%. But when using the Vineland protocol, we're seeing survival rates of higher than 85% in a lot of cases.
Speaking of expertise, you've got Mark Cullen involved in the project, right? Well, he's one of the co-chairs, I think, right?
Yeah, he is. He is one of our co-founders and one of the individuals that would have been part of that meeting, which was sort of that created the catalyst for this program that I alluded to earlier. Tony DiGiovanni put forward the idea. And Mark was so inspired by it that he decided to write about it in his syndicated column. And the response from that was quite incredible. People actually began to send in checks and said, Mark, you need to make this happen.
So, Mike, you want to be able to plant 117,000 trees for every soldier who fell for Canada. So how can people help with that goal?
Well, first of all, I say our goal has actually increased since our launch from 117,000 trees to 2 million trees. What started as a mission to plant a tree for every Canadian that has ever lost a life while serving has expanded into a mission to planting a tree for every Canadian that has ever served during times of conflict in our armed forces. People can get involved in one of three ways. The first is to donate. Visit hohtribute.ca, click the donate button. All donations are tax receipt eligible, and we need to raise $10 million to get this project completed. The second way to get involved is actually through a very great partnership that we have with our friends at Forest Ontario. If you own property that is within close proximity to the 401 corridor, within about 30 kilometers or so, you can visit our website, and there's information there on our private landowners planting partnership program. And through this program, you can actually have 80 to 90% of the cost of planting trees on your property fully subsidized. And the third way to get involved is to come out and join us at one of our many public community tree planting events that we do every year. We typically do anywhere from 6 to 10 of these, and they are in various communities along the Highway of Heroes. And it's quite simply an opportunity to come out, roll up your sleeves, get your hands dirty, and take part in the act of planting a tree that is in honor of somebody that has fought to protect and to serve our country.
Well, it's a great, great idea, and I hope that a lot of Harrismith listeners join in one way or the other to help out with the effort. And I'm sure we'll be talking again about this. So thanks very much for joining us today to tell us, to just sort of fill us in a little bit about the project.
It's my pleasure.
That was Mike Hurley, ready to get his hands dirty for a great cause. So, here we are at the end of this episode of Harrismith Radio. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please consider subscribing to this podcast on Apple iTunes or in your favorite podcast player. And please, tell your friends and family. Got feedback? We'd love to hear it. You can email us at letters@harrismithmag.com. That URL, harrismithmag.com, is also where you can order subscriptions online. And you can find Harrismith Magazine on selected newsstands across Canada. Until next time, for Harrismith Radio, I'm Wayne McPhail. And also, until next time, remember these four words: make, grow, sustain, share. Tune in for the next episode of Harrismith Radio.